You know, if we learn and then reflect on what we've learned, if we learn and reflect on the lessons of history, I think it helps us deal with the present, the times in which we now live. And as you and I live now here in the Church of God in the year 2018, we observe what's happening in the world around us, at least in our part of the world, but to the degree we keep track of what's going on in other parts of the world, I suppose we could be forgiven if from time to time we wonder if everything's upside down and chaotic and out of control. It seems that way. And the longer you've lived and the more memories you have of 40, 50 or more years ago in this same country, you realize what a different place it is. What a different place it is. And as I said, I think we could be forgiven if sometimes we let our minds arrive at the conclusion that things are totally out of control, that really anything could happen from this point on. It seems almost like anything has happened already, just with increasing speed by way of change and none of it for the better. So we might allow ourselves to arrive at the conclusion, well, from this point on, anything could happen. And I want to talk about that a bit today. As we observe what is happening around, could anything happen from this point out? We observe what's happening in the world. We can better understand what we see. I think what we're going to talk about today can have the effect of giving us more peace of mind, even in the midst of all this that we see, this craziness, this apparent chaos. If we consider and learn properly the lessons of history. And anybody can read history, but it's important to read true history, not false history, and then to understand what we've read when we've read true history. Of course, there's much true history in the Bible. So if we consider the lessons of true history and then properly understand it, I think it can have the effect that's helpful to us of more peace of mind. In many people's eyes, the chaos and the craziness of the world means that just about anything could happen from this point out, that anything is possible. We're going to take a look at some history today with the goal of understanding it and then helping us deal with the present and the immediate future a little bit better of what will happen instead of being overwhelmed by the possibilities of what could happen. We're going to talk about what will happen instead of just being overwhelmed by this possibility that anything could happen and being overwhelmed by that. First of all, we're going to look at some military history. I don't know if you're like me, but when I was going through school, I didn't really like history. I don't think I really had many very good history teachers. That can make a big difference, a subject in school. If you have a really good teacher who engages your interest, you can fall in love with that subject. I guess I never had one of those. I didn't really like history study. But since then, since I can read what I choose to read at the pace I want to read it, I enjoy reading history. But at times I have to take a break from it, because most of history is the history of war and violence and suffering. And at times you have to just kind of take a break from it, because it can get to you. But we're going to consider some military history, some important battles, some of which you've probably heard of and others maybe you haven't. The first one I want to consider with you is the Battle of Waterloo. I'd say most people here have heard of the Battle of Waterloo. It was fought in Belgium, in Western Europe, in June of 1815. And it was fought between an alliance of several countries on one side and one other country on the other side. The alliance was an alliance of English and Belgian and Prussian forces. And when you hear the word Prussia, think German. English, Belgian, and Prussian forces on one side. And the leader of that alliance was mainly British General Arthur Wellesley, better known as the Duke of Wellington. Secondarily, that alliance was led by a Prussian general named Blücher. Now, a raid against the other side, and the other side were the forces of France, led by Napoleon Bonaparte. In many people's eyes, Napoleon was the greatest general of his time. In fact, some people would say one of the greatest generals, tacticians, strategists of all time, military leaders. In many people's eyes, he was almost impossible to defeat. One time, weather beat him. I'm not sure the enemy beat him, but weather beat him one time. But in a fair fight, it was almost impossible to beat Napoleon. One historical source I read said that on the eve of the final battle, Waterloo was actually a campaign with several days and several battles, but on the eve of the climactic battle, which was fought on June 18th of 1815, this one historian I was reading said the odds heavily favored Napoleon. So if there had been a Vegas back in the days, the smart money would have been on Napoleon. Probably on the evening of June 17th, probably most of the smart money was on Napoleon. Very few military observers would have been surprised had Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo. But he didn't. He did not win. Even though he won Wellington, the one who did win, he had some interesting things to say the very next day and in subsequent times. He had some very interesting things to say about a battle he won. Here are a couple of quotes from the Duke of Wellington the day after the battle, the climactic Battle of Waterloo. These were quotes on June 19th. In one case, he wrote his brother a letter. He wrote his brother, William, a letter on June 19th, the day after the climactic battle, and he said this, quote, you're going to read about this on the newspapers, but he says, "You'll see the account of our desperate battle and victory over Boney." I guess if you win, you get to call the other guy whatever you want. He called Bonaparte Boney. "You'll see the account of our desperate battle and victory over Boney. It was the most desperate business I was ever in, and never was I so near to being beat." Even the winner said, "I came this close to losing. It was tottering like a drunk man in a wind. It could have gone either way." There's a word for that. It's called contingent. It could have gone either way. And even the winner said that. Also on the day after the battle, also on June the 19th, another British civilian, a man named Thomas Creevey, happened to be right near the battle site, and he made his way to Wellington's headquarters, and he talked with Wellington on the day after the battle. And I have to clean this one up. This quote I have to clean up a little bit for you. But Creevey reports that this is what Wellington said. Quote, "It has been a blankety-blank nice thing." Nice, that's kind of a strange word to use. It was gore and horrible suffering and carnage. But that's the word. It was a blankety-blank nice thing. The nearest run thing you ever saw in your life. Now, we're somewhat startled they would use the word nice, but authorities tell us that nice had a different... One of the meanings of nice in the English language back in those days was different than we think of. We think of nice as polite or affable or well-mannered, something like that, pleasant. One of the meanings of the word nice, apparently, in the English language back in 1815 was contingent, iffy, could have gone either way. So it was a blankety-blank, iffy, contingent thing. It could have gone either way. In fact, he said, the nearest run thing you ever saw in your life. In Wellington's mind, the outcome was contingent. It could have gone the other way. He could have lost. In his own mind, he could have lost. It was iffy. It was a near-run thing. He said, "I was never so close to being beat in any battle." In his mind, he could have lost. All right, you might file that away for a minute. I want to go to another historical event, another battle. We'll turn our attention to another battle. It was not fought as long ago as with Waterloo. This is the Battle of Midway. Now, this was a naval battle, not a land battle. It was the Battle of Midway. It was fought in the Pacific Ocean in the early stages of America's involvement in World War II. Fought June 4th through 7th of 1942. A sea battle between the Japanese Navy and the United States Navy. Now, in this case, one side, the Japanese, had an enormous tactical and numeric advantage. Again, if there, you know, there was Vegas in those times, the smart money was on the Japanese Navy on the eve of this battle. I'll quote several historical sources here who talk about the Battle of Midway. This is from an article by a military historian named Benjamin Baker. It appeared in a British publication called The Diplomat here a couple of years ago. Here's what he says. There is a story that war gamers at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, have replayed the 1942 Battle of Midway many times. Now, when we have war games, or at least on paper, they simulate many times, given the ships and the generals and the amount of armaments and all that of the two sides, and they run simulations. What if this move had been made quicker or later? They just look at all the ways that that battle could have played out. And apparently, every time the Americans lose, the only time the Americans won was the reality of the actual Battle of Midway. But on paper, they had no business winning. The Americans always lose. Almost more than any other during the Second World War, this battle was won due to a fortunate combination of good intelligence, planning, and most of all, luck. The U.S. Navy was far inferior to its Japanese counterparts in terms of numbers and experience, but it was still able to sink all four of the Japanese Imperial Navy's aircraft carriers that were in the battle, all four of them. This marked the beginning of the long, grueling, Allied island-hopping advance in the Pacific, eventually culminating in Japan's defeat over 3 years later. But this turned the tide in the Pacific Ocean. Further, the Battle of Midway remains a well-known and cherished memory in U.S. military history. In a book by Theodore Cook, professor at the William Patterson University of New Jersey, he gives a great account of how there are several points, both before and during the battle, that history easily could have taken a different path. The outcome was contingent. In June of 1942, Imperial Japan had reached the zenith of its conquests. The Japanese Empire stretched from China to Wake Island and from the Aleutians to Indonesia. It had decimated the United States Navy at Pearl Harbor, although crucially, many of the U.S. aircraft carriers were out of port and were not destroyed in the attack on Pearl Harbor. It had conquered all Europe and American colonies in Southeast Asia, including Singapore. Many people know about Pearl Harbor, but the very same day, the Japanese attacked the English fortress of Singapore and took it very quickly, and Winston Churchill called the fall of Singapore the greatest single military setback in the history of the British Empire. It was a devastating loss. So that's already happened. Japan has definitely got the odds in its favor, and it's on a roll. Although the Japanese and American navies, coming back to Midway, had fought an inconclusive battle at the Coral Sea, in which each side lost one aircraft carrier, the Imperial Japanese Navy retained the strategic initiative. The smart money is on Japan. The commander of the U.S. forces at the Battle of Midway was Admiral James Spruance. All that Spruance left behind, so he had his command ship and a few other boats to protect it. He had a lot of naval aircraft. He sent almost all of it out to look for the Japanese carriers to attack them. He left very little back to protect himself. All he left behind were sufficient planes to give his command ship, aerial cover. The rest of all of his airplanes were sent in one roll of the dice. I mean, you get one shot at this. The rest were sent into the air to attack the Japanese fleet, but before that, they had to find them. They didn't know where they were. They thought they did. So the rest of his airplanes were sent to attack the Japanese fleet. Spruance's planes left at 7:52 in the morning. They were led by Lieutenant Commander McCluskey. He sent out three kinds of planes. Fighter aircraft. Those are the ones that stay up in the air, and if the Japanese send down any planes, then our planes will fight them in air battles. So he sent out some fighters. Then he also sent torpedo bombers and dive bombers. I didn't know all this, so I studied this, but apparently there's two ways to sink a big ship. One is to blow a hole in the side. If you're going to blow the hole in the side, you've got to come at it at almost sea level. So what torpedo bombers are planes with torpedoes or bombs under their wings, and they just skim along. As they see the enemy ships out here, they just skim along right over the surface of the water, and when they get close, they release their torpedoes, and then they veer off, and their torpedoes blow a hole in the side of the enemy ship. The other way is dive bombers. Planes that circle over on top of the ship, and they try to blow a hole in the top of the ship, on its landing surface. So they dive down, release their bombs, take off, and try to blow a hole in the top of the ship. So he sends his fighters, his torpedo bombers and his dive bombers. There were 67 dive bombers, 29 torpedo bombers, and 20 Wildcat fighters. But they were at a great disadvantage. They didn't know where the enemy was. They thought they did, so they go out searching for the enemies, the four aircraft carriers and all the other ships. They were spread out over a large area, and communication between the U.S. flight leaders was very difficult. Besides that, there's a heavy cloud cover. If you're up in the air and there's clouds, it's going to be hard to even see what's at the surface of the water. Unknown to them, the Japanese Admiral Nagumo had changed course, and when the U.S. planes arrived at the point where they believed the Japanese would be, they were gone. They found nothing. Now they start to run out of fuel. Some planes searched in vain. A lot of the fighter planes had to ditch. They just lost their lives. They ran out of fuel, and the pilot and plane went into the sea. Some planes searched in vain. A lot of the fighters had to ditch. They ran out of fuel. However, the torpedo squadrons, they finally found the enemy, but the enemy saw them too. The torpedo squadrons coming in low, flying low, did find the Japanese carriers, but they had no fighter planes left because they're all in the water now to support them, to protect them. So it was very iffy that the torpedo bombers would have a chance, because long before they got to the enemy craft, there were guns on the enemy ships that they would hit the torpedo bombers before they ever got close enough. But despite this risk, Lieutenant Commander Waldron, who was in charge of the torpedo bomber, he gave a final message, very courageous, right before they made their run. He said, "My greatest hope is that we encounter a favorable tactical situation. But if we don't, I want each of us to do our utmost to destroy the enemies. If there's only one plane, one torpedo plane left to make a final run in, I want that man to go in and get a hit. May God be with us." Well, the way it turned out, not one torpedo bomber got close enough before it was shot out of the air. It wasn't high in the air, but shot, and the torpedo bombers did nothing. So now there's no fighter aircraft on the U.S. side. There's no, all we got left, no torpedo bombers. All that was left, the dive bombers. About that time, the heavens opened, the clouds, and they saw the target. And the dive bombers of the United States Naval Fleet were able to destroy all four Japanese aircraft carriers. The Japanese lost. The money in Vegas was on the Japanese, but they lost. They lost the heart of their Navy that day. They never recovered for the rest of the war. One historical source put it this way: the American forces defeated an attacking fleet of the Imperial Japanese Navy near Midway, inflicting devastating damage on the Japanese fleet that proved irreparable. There's a famous military historian from England named John Keegan. He studied wars ancient and modern. He says this. He said it was the most stunning and decisive blow in the history of naval warfare. Well, was it a near-run thing, the Battle of Midway? Sure seems to be from that description. Seems like it was pretty iffy. Seems like it could easily have gone the other way. Was it a near-run thing? As likely as not to go the other way. Now, if you'll bear with me, I want to talk about a third battle. An ancient battle. This is also a naval battle. Maybe one we haven't heard about. The Battle of Salamis, or Salamis. This was a great naval battle between the Persians and the Greeks. It took place in the year 480 B.C. Now, before I go into that, you're probably wondering, are you ever going to get into the Bible? We're going to get into the Bible. We're making a point here. We want to look at some history, and then we certainly will filter it through some things in the Bible here in a little bit. But at this point, I just want to make reference to the Bible, Daniel 7. I think we're very familiar with the fact that God revealed to the prophet Daniel essentially the history of the Gentile powers that would be dominant in the Mediterranean world, which is essentially where the people of God's nation, Israel and Judah, were. The beast power. And there were four stages, as outlined in the prophecies of Daniel 2 and 7, but specifically in Daniel 7. The first one was likened to a lion, and we've identified that as Babylon. And then that gave way to another beast power likened to a bear, and we've identify that as Persia, Medo-Persian Empire. The third one was likened to a leopard, and we've identified that with the Greeks under Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire. And of course, fourthly, a terrible beast, indescribable, the Roman Empire and its resurrections. Well, just common sense says if God has put his name and his authority on the line, that the lion has to at some point give way to the bear, and the bear has to at some point give way to the leopard, and the leopard has to at some point give way to the final beast, that it cannot go any other way. At some point, the bear is going to lose out to the leopard, or God's word is untrue. Keep that thought in mind as we talk about the Battle of Salamis. At this point in 480 BC, the bear is still king of the hill. The bear, the Persians are mighty and powerful and almost undisputed. But there's this little baby cub leopard over here in Greece starting to flex its little muscles. And so in the Battle of Salamis, the Persians decide to go kill the cub leopard before it ever has a chance to ever become a threat. So this battle is fought on Greek soil, and the mighty Persians are coming over on Greek soil to destroy this upstart so it never really is a threat. That's the setting. But at some point, the bear has to give way to the leopard. Many people are aware of a little bit of an earlier battle before Salamis that was also fought in 480 BC. It was called the Battle of Thermopylae. They made a movie about it a few years ago, the 300 brave Spartan warriors under King Leonidas who were going to fight to the death, to the last man, to hold off the tens of 300 were going to hold off tens of thousands of Persian soldiers, and for several days they did. While the historic stand of Sparta under King Leonidas and the 300 brave Spartans at Thermopylae in the year 480 BC has become perhaps the most well-known chapter in the wars between Greece and Persia, King Xerxes, another instance of an outnumbered Greek force battling an enormous invading force from Persia occurred soon after in the same year, 480 BC, the Battle of Salamis. Subsequent to the annihilation of the 300 Spartans, several more engagements were lost, and Athens was abandoned. Greece, the little cub leopard, is about to be killed by this giant bear. Athens is abandoned. The Spartans all died. They put up a brave fight, but they're all dead. The Greek forces fell back, while the Persian Emperor Xerxes pressed forward to what looked to be a clear victory. If there's a Vegas then, everybody's putting their money on Xerxes and the Persians. However, the tides were about to turn. Despite their numerical inferiority, the Greeks planned another battle, this time at sea. Luring the overeager Persian ships into the Straits of Salamis, the small Greek force launched their attack. Although the invading navy of Persia consisted of three times as many ships, whose odds do you like? 3-1. I'll take the 3 most times, won't you? Three times as many ships as the defenders. Their numbers actually, in this case, proved to be a hindrance in the narrow straits of Salamis. While Xerxes' ships struggled to maneuver effectively, smaller and more nimble Greek vessels, outnumbered 3-1, were able to just move in and out around them and knock holes in the sides of the Persian ships. Soon the enemy was in disarray, taking heavy losses, struggling to maintain any kind of counterattack. Following their resounding defeat on the ocean, the Persian invasion began to falter and was ultimately repaired. Did they succeed in killing the little leopard cub before it ever had a chance to become a big leopard? No. And the Persians licked their wounds and went back to Persia. The Battle of Salamis marked a turning point in the Greco-Persian Wars. It actually started the gradual transition from bear to leopard. After Salamis, Greece was safe from conquest. The Persians never came back. And that gave the Greeks a chance to get stronger and stronger and stronger. The little cub leopard is growing up and getting stronger. And also the Persians suffered a major blow to their prestige. Everybody thought they were undefeatable. Salamis started a decisive swing in the balance of power toward the Greeks, which would culminate in an eventual Greek victory much, much later under Alexander. But it had to start somewhere. Salamis has gained something of a legendary status, perhaps because of the desperate circumstances and the unlikely odds faced by the Greeks. A significant number of historians have stated that Salamis is one of the most significant battles in human history. The argument goes like this. If the Greeks had lost at Salamis, the ensuing conquest of Greece by the Persians would have effectively stifled the growth of Western civilization. There would have been no Greek culture. There would have been no leopard. It would have died in infancy. Persian domination of Greeks might have changed the whole trajectory of human history. It has been widely known that a number of credible historians believed a Persian win at the Battle of Salamis would have hindered the thriving development of ancient Greek and thus of Western civilization, etc., etc. The flourish of Greek culture occurred only after the Persian Wars were won, and they were paved by the Battle of Salamis. One more battle, bear with me. Another battle, 150 years later, this time still between Greece and Persia. But now the little cub has grown up. One more battle in ancient history, the Battle of Gaugamela. Even if you haven't heard of it, you've heard of one of its main participants, Alexander the Great. In the time of Alexander, it was finally time for a decisive battle between the Persians and Greeks. Once and for all, who's the beast? Who's going to rule the world of that day? The Battle of Gaugamela. Now, just one little side note. The church has talked about these issues over many decades, and in describing the giving way of Persia, the giving way of the bear, the second aspect of the beast, to the third one, Greece, the leopard, we've often pointed to the Battle of Issus in the year 333 BC, and that was clearly an important battle. It was also won by Alexander the Great. It was fought in 333. But the coup de grace was 2 years later at the Battle of Gaugamela. That was certainly a decisive victory for the Greeks over the Persians. In 333, Issus. But it was 2 years later when the bear was finally put out of its misery and the leopard is now undisputed. Darius was the leader of the Persians at Gaugamela, and Alexander the Great was the leader of the Greeks. Following the assassination of Philip II, his father, Alexander and his army left their home of Macedonia for the last time and set out on a goal of conquering all of Persia. So this is just different from what it was back 150 years earlier. Now, Greek is going to play on Persia's home turf. And if you can beat Persia on their home turf, the battle's over. Greek wins. Darius and his generals underestimated the abilities of the young Alexander. They thought he was an upstart. They did not fear him. They did not respect him. Again, the smart money. To Darius, it appeared the size of his army and the terrain gave him a significant advantage. At the Battle of Gaugamela, Alexander had 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry, but he was massively outnumbered, and he's on the other guy's home turf. The Persians, under Darius, had well over 100,000 men. What was the result of this Battle of Gaugamela? It was a stunning and complete victory by the underdog, by the Greeks. The Battle of Gaugamela was the final meeting between Alexander the Great and Darius III of Persia. After this victory, Alexander was without question the king of all Asia. Encyclopedia Britannica puts it this way. The Greek victory at Gaugamela spelled the end of the Persian Empire. The bear is dead. Founded by Cyrus II and left Alexander the master of Asia. All right, now we've talked about four battles. All of these great battles were upsets. David beat Goliath in every case. The smart money was on Goliath, and no case did Goliath win. At minimum, even taking into account greater bravery on the part of the underdog or greater tactical skills, even taking all that into account, at minimum, we would say it was a near-run thing. On the night before each of these battles, you would at minimum say this could go either way. Most people would say it's going to go the way of Goliath. But at minimum, you could say this is going to be close. There's no way to predict. These are going to be close calls. These are contingent affairs. The outcome teeters on one side or the other. That's what it would seem in each case. And yet, the question I want is, was it really? Were any of them contingent? Were any of them near-run affairs or close calls? And I believe the answer is no in every case. When God is involved in human history, it's not even close. The outcome is hardwired. It's going to go one way and only one way. If God has determined things are going to go a way, it's going to go that way 100% of the time. When God has predetermined an outcome, it doesn't matter what the odds are going in, how outnumbered the one God has chosen to win is, it's going to go that way every time. The Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 1 described prophecy, including the prophecy of the Bible, including the prophecy of the Bible as understood in New Testament times, now that we have the help of the Holy Spirit. And he described it in a very interesting way. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19. He says, "We also have the prophetic word made more sure." You can think of cases where God revealed prophecies to a prophet, and the prophet didn't even understand what it meant. Like in Daniel's case. He wanted to know, what's this mean? He could write it down. He knew the word. What does this mean? God said, it's not for you to know. I'm not saying the Holy Spirit wasn't given to Daniel, but it wasn't God's time for it to be known. But now Peter talks about the more sure. And in other translations, I say more certain. More certain. Prophecy is certain. It's not contingent. When God has said something's going to go down this path, it doesn't matter what the odds appear ahead of time that it's going to go. There's no way it's going to go there. It's not contingent. This isn't even a possibility. It's going that way. None of those really, in my opinion, were near-run affairs, because all of them, at least in my opinion, involved Israel in some way or another, or God's prophecies about the beast power in one way or another, that had it gone the other way, prophecy would have failed, and God will not let that happen. When we read and believe the words of God's prophets in the Bible, we realize that God is involved in human history, and in some cases that means he's involved in human battles. These pivotal battles. I'm not saying every battle, every war, but in ones that are pivotal as to whether prophecy is going to be fulfilled or not, God is involved. And when he is, it's not a near-run affair. It's not contingent. It can't go either way. It can only go one way. Isaiah, there are several scriptures that we can look at now that really cement that point. When God's involved in history, it is not contingent. It's not close. It's not 80-20 or even 90-10. It's 100-0. 100% of the time it'll go one way. Even though we weren't aware of it ahead of time, God was. And 0% of the time will it go the other way. So here's Isaiah 14. Verse 24, probably very familiar scriptures to us, but they underscored this point. The Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, surely, there's no contingency here. Isaiah 14, verse 24, surely, as I have thought, so it shall come to pass, 100% of the time. And as I have purposed, so it shall stand. God had purposed that the bear was going to give way to the leopard. He was not going to let the leopard cub be destroyed before it ever had a chance to grow up. And when it did grow up, he wasn't going to let the leopard in the climatic battle against the bear lose to the bear. It wasn't going to happen that way. Later in the book of Isaiah, you know, Reuben and Joseph when they don't know who they are, Reuben has not ever got over the fact he lost the birthright to Joseph. I don't believe the French were going to win that Battle of Waterloo. I don't think it was in the cards. And we could talk about other pivotal turning points in history, especially as it involves who we understand to be God's people, the Israels of God, where it seemed going in the eve of the battle it could go either way. I don't think it could go either way. We could talk about maybe the Spanish Armada. I don't think the Spanish Armada had a chance, even though it sure looked like they were going to be victorious. Little Round Top. You read about the 20th Maine Regiment and the Alabama, whatever it was, regiment. It seemed, even by Lee's recollection, it was so close. I don't think it really was. I had a great-great-great-grandfather who wore gray, and I had a great-great-great-grandfather who, on the other side of my family, who wore blue. But the guys who wore gray, they were not going to win that war. I'm just convinced of it. From what we understand about God's purposes, the full blessings, the full birthright blessings had not yet been given to Manasseh. And to have two nations, enemies within the count, that was not in the plan, I don't believe. I don't think there was any chance the people wearing gray were going to win that war, although at times it sure looked like it. They were on the verge of it. That just wasn't in the cards. But Isaiah 46, verse 9. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there's no other. I am God, and there's none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning. So if the end of the battle is option A, and that's how prophecy is fulfilled, and there are other options, they're not even possibly going to happen. It's going to be option A, not B, C, or D. That would have caused prophecy to fail, because God is fully capable of pulling strings behind the scenes to see that only A happens. So it really wasn't a near-run thing. It wasn't contingent. So he says he declares the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man who executes my counsel. It's almost certainly a reference to Cyrus, who's the one who founded the Bear Power, the Persian Empire. God called a man by name over a century before he was even born, gave him a job. He was going to be successful. Cyrus, leading the Persians, was going to defeat the Babylonians. The Persians were not going to lose to the Babylonians. They were going to win. They were going to be victorious. Calling a bird of prey from the east, a man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I've spoken it. I will bring it to pass. When God says that, there is no contingency involved. I have purposed it. I will also do it. Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted. If you're stubbornly going to go put your money on Goliath, just be prepared to lose it. There's no way you're winning. Who are far from righteousness, I bring my righteousness near. It shall not be far off. My salvation shall not linger. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. I think that it's significant that God brings the name Zion and Israel into this discussion when he's talking about the certainty that his prophecies will be fulfilled, that he will bring it to pass. When Israel, the focus of God's attention, is a part of the equation, God will pull whatever strings need to be pulled so that God's prophecies with regard to Israel, its rise and its fall, will 100% of the time be fulfilled. God's direct interventions in world histories, in battles, in appointments of its leaders, in ways that lead to surprising results or unlikely results, nearly always has as its main purpose the working out of God's prophecies concerning either the beast power or Israel. That's usually the case. Now, Deuteronomy 32, verse 39. It's more of the same, where we see that certain events in history aren't contingent at all. They're hardwired. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 39. Now see that I, even I, am he. There's no God besides me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Nor is there any who can deliver from my hand. I don't care what the odds are. Nobody can reverse it. And then one more on this point in Isaiah 43. Verse 13. This is Isaiah 43 and verse 13. Indeed, before the day was, I am he. There is no one who can deliver out of my hand. I work. Who will reverse it? So maybe we ought to pause and say, note to the Duke of Wellington, maybe it wasn't as near on a thing as you thought it was. you weren't as close to being beat as maybe you even thought you were. You know, note to Darius, you didn't have a chance against Alexander. It wasn't going to go your way. Note to Admiral Nagumo, you're not going to win this battle. I don't care if you have many more, how many more ships you have than the U.S., you're not going to win. So I think that's history, and that's the understanding of certain portions of history, and it's important to internalize that lesson from history. The odds have nothing to do with it. If God's in the fight, the human factors are irrelevant. The underdog will win if that's God's purpose. Now, you can probably think of many other examples. But now I want to turn to our ancestors. I want to turn to one more battle. So this will be the fifth battle we look at. It's a battle involving God's covenant people, where all the money in Vegas was on the one who actually lost. The two sides of this battle, on one case you have God's covenant people of Judah, and on the other side you have the Assyrians. It's recorded in the 18th and 19th chapters of 2 Kings. Now, if you're just looking at this impending battle with human eyes and human understanding on the eve of the battle, you'd almost certainly put your money on the Assyrians. Let's look at it. We'll look at certain portions of this. This goes on for a couple of chapters. We certainly won't read every verse, but we'll look at selected verses. 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 11. So it says, the king of Assyria did carry away Israel. Now that's the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes. 2 Kings 18 and verse 11. The king of Syria did carry away Israel unto Assyria and put them in Hala and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes because they obeyed not the voice of the Eternal their God. They'd had decades, if not centuries, of time when this could have already happened, but God was merciful and patient. But at some point they stepped across even God's line of patience, and God knew it would be no longer good for them, really, for his own namesake and for his holiness' sake, but even good for them to be permitted to get away with just defiance. So it's at this point, it says, the reason this is about to happen or has happened, because they transgressed his covenant and all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded and would not hear them nor do them. So things had come to the point in God's relationship with the northern 10 tribes that it was now God's will that they go into captivity, so they did. Their time to avoid severe chastisement was over, and it was time to not avoid it, but go through it. In the year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them? So now the only remaining question is Jerusalem going to fall? Most of the cities of Judah, even their armed cities, had fallen to the Assyrians. The northern 10 tribes have already fallen to the Syrians. The only question remaining was, is Jerusalem's time up also? Or was there enough of a core, just a core, maybe not a majority, but somehow is there enough of a core of people down in Judah, in Jerusalem, including their king, including their prophet, the prophet of God, is there enough there that God in his mercy would reverse the momentum? That's the real question. Because, you know, we if we're not careful, we say, okay, God let the Assyrians take the northern tribes of Samaria, but when they went south, he stopped them, and Judah was spared. Much of Judah was not spared. It says he took the cities. The focus is on Jerusalem. Many of the cities of Judah were taken. They were not spared. So that's the question. Is there enough of a core that God says, I'll spare the temple, I'll spare Jerusalem? Maybe there are other considerations that we're not aware of, but does God have some lessons he wants the participants to learn, have it recorded in history so we can learn from it? That's really the only question. Is God going to pull some strings behind the scenes? Because if God doesn't pull some strings behind the scenes, Jerusalem's going down. That's all the momentum is going that way. Assyria is Goliath. Jerusalem is David. All right, so we skip a few verses. We go down to verse 22. Now, you've got this blabbermouth, this proud. The sermonette talked about pride. Well, here is pride on display. This German general, this Assyrian general, who can't keep his mouth shut. He is going, I'll get ahead of the story, he's going to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. He couldn't keep his mouth shut. If you say unto me, we trust the eternal Lord God. So he's challenging God's prophet and Hezekiah the king, and maybe there is a righteous core still in Jerusalem. And here's this part of this encircling army who's challenging. Oh, you're going to trust God? You're going to trust Yahweh? Forget about it. If you say unto me, we trust in the eternal our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and has said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem. Now therefore I pray you, give pledges to my Lord, the king of Assyria, and I'll deliver you 2,000 horses. We're so confident of beating you, but I don't even think you got 2,000 people who can fight. If you can find 2,000 people to fight, I'll give you horses for all of them. I'll give you 2,000 of our horses. Oh, and he's just, you know, going and blowing. So proud. I'll give you 2,000 of our horses if you're able to find riders for them. How then will you turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servant? We don't even have to throw our whole battle force against you. We'll make it a fair fight. You send what you got, we'll send the equipment up, we'll slaughter you. And it just goes on and on. Pride, bragging. Verse 25, am I now come up without the eternal against this place to destroy? In fact, your God that you're going to trust in, he's behind us. He's told us to destroy you. So you don't even have that to fall back on. The eternal, Yahweh, said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Okay, now we go down to verse 35. Who were they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of my hand? We always win. Nobody can withstand our army. And you won't be able to. Tell me one person who's defeated us, one army who's defeated. Who are they among all the gods of the countries? Not only their armies, but their gods. There's no god that can defeat our Assyrian gods, and there's no army that can defeat our Assyrian army. Look at verse 35 again. Who are they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of my hand, that the eternal should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? He just stepped over a line. Because God's hearing this. The Jews in Jerusalem are hearing it, but so is God. This Assyrian general just went one step too far. He said boastfully that Hezekiah's God, Isaiah's God, not only would not, but could not intervene to give David a victory over Goliath. And that's a step too far. So we go to chapter 19 and verse 1. So it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard all this, he rent his clothes, he covered himself with sackcloth, and he went into the house of the Eternal. Judah was actually blessed by one of the few somewhat righteous kings that ever ruled under either Samaria or Judah. Samaria never had one righteous king that I can find. Judah didn't have many, but this one was a pretty righteous king. So he's going to take his troubles to God. Came to pass, King Hezekiah heard it. He rent his clothes. He covered himself with sackcloth. And he went into the house of the Eternal. And he sent Eliakim, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, God's prophet. In verse 6, Isaiah said unto them, thus shall you say to your master, thus saith the Eternal, be not afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Then verse 14, and Hezekiah went up into the house of the Eternal, and he spread this Assyrian challenge before God. And Hezekiah prayed before the Eternal and said, O Eternal God of Israel, which dwell between the cherubim, you are the God. Even you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth. Eternal, bow down your ear and hear. Open, Eternal, your eyes and see. And hear the words of Sennacherib, which has sent him to reproach the living God. Of a truth eternal, the kings of Assyria have destroyed the nations and their lands. It is true, no nation can stand up against this army, but we're trusting you, the God, the Creator God, to do what no nation can do. It's true that the kings of Assyria have destroyed the nations and their lands. Verse 18, and have cast their gods into the fire, gods which aren't really gods. For they were no gods. This is the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they have destroyed them. Now therefore, O eternal our God, I beseech you, save you us out of his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the eternal God, you only. This whole matter ceased to be contingent, and it ceased to be a near-run thing. Verse 35, it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote the camp of the Assyrians in the camp 185,000. The army of Israel, of Judah, didn't have to lift their hands except praying to God. An angel can take out the greatest army single-handedly. This is a one-punch knockout. First round, 185,000. They didn't see that one coming in Vegas, did they? They didn't see the whole army being killed by an angel in their tents. And when they arose in the morning, they were all dead corpses. So we ask the question like we've asked before. Who saw that coming? Who saw that coming? But does it matter who saw it coming if God's involved? Memo to General Rabshakeh. And King Sennacherib, you never had a chance, especially when you stepped over that pride line. This was not a near-run thing. This wasn't even going to be close. So as you and I find ourselves living in these end times, which are apparently chaotic and out of control, and it appears that anything could happen from now on, we need to draw back and say, no, not anything can happen. Some things can't happen, and some things will happen. They're hardwired to happen. And other things can't happen because they would go against Bible prophecy. The world looks like it's spinning out of control, but really it's very much under control, just like it has been in these five previous cases. If we watch the news all the time, we can probably go out of our minds with a thought that anything can happen. And you know, what's going to happen with these investigations? Who's going to get killed and who's going to get locked up? Well, at that level of detail, maybe that's contingent. But the really true big-ticket items of our future of this country and every other country, it's pretty much hardwired because there's prophecies about them in the Bible. So I think we could have a little bit more peace of mind knowing there's somebody there to see to it that it all has a happy ending. The majority of the future is not contingent, it's not iffy, and it's not a near-run thing. It's all under control, because the only God who is there to see to it. So let's just conclude with these thoughts. Aren't we glad that the end result of our chaotic times now is not a near-run thing, that it's not contingent? The kingdom of God won't almost not come. It's not going to almost not happen. The kingdom of Christ won't almost not return. God's plan won't almost fail. God's church won't almost be destroyed or wiped out. What a wonderful certainty the good things of God are. There will certainly, not maybe, certainly be great challenges on the way to the kingdom of God, but there also will certainly be great and everlasting blessings and happiness in the kingdom of God. In the overall sense of things, nothing is contingent and everything is under control.